Welcome, everyone, to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I am your host, Jimmy Traina. Thanks so much for joining me. Two guests this week. First up, we have Greg Wyshynski of ESPN, senior NHL writer at ESPN, longtime blogger from the internet, had one of the great blogs, the top hockey blog probably from the internet, Puck Daddy on Yahoo, went to ESPN. And we get to into Greg's career going from sort of, you know, the Wild West of the internet and Yahoo to ESPN, the evolution of his career, the evolution of the internet, little NHL talk about the future of the NHL in terms of broadcast, TV, streaming. And if you're a hockey fan, you'll like it. And if you're not a hockey fan and you're into the sports media business, I think you'll enjoy it thoroughly. And after Greg, I have a quick chat with one of my best friends, Rich O'Malley, I went to college with. He has a new book out. It's called One Lucky Fan. And Rich decided in his life that one of his goals would be to see every single stadium and arena for every team from the four major sports leagues. So Rich has seen every stadium and arena, MLB, NHL, NFL, NBA. He wrote a book about it. It's pretty good. I wrote the foreword, so I had to have him on. So Greg Wyshynski on sports media in the NHL, and then Rich O'Malley on seeing all the stadiums and arenas in this country. On this episode of the SI Media Podcast, go into the archives if you haven't checked out past episodes. Last week's was a very good episode. We had Darren Rovell and Andrew Marchand. We've got Chris Long in the archives, newly retired from the Eagles, and Mike Breen as well, who's still calling the NBA Finals. So check those out. And I don't want to beg and plead, but if you can leave a review and rate the podcast, I cannot tell you how much it helps. I'd love for you to subscribe too, but rating is easy. You could just hit the stars. A review is good. You could just write, this is great. Not a lot of work. If you hit that subscription button, it's even better. All right. Thanks for doing that. And now let's get into this episode with Greg Wyshynski from ESPN. All right. Joining me now from ESPN, senior NHL writer, longtime internet sensation, if you're old school blogs remember those days finally like I do. Greg Wyshynski. Greg, how's it going?
It's going good, and everywhere I turn there seems to be some wily veteran of the blog days that I bump into, or that's still kicking around or has moved on to bigger and better things. It's fun to think about where we all started and where we all ended up.
We're about the same age, early 40s, and I don't know. I know for me, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. I look back on those blog days. The most fun, every day was fun, it seemed like, and it was so great, all these new people. I always think of you, and I think of the starters, and which is kind of, it was ironic for, I don't know if that's the proper use of ironic. I know people get mad when you don't use it properly, like Alanis, but, you know, I reached out to you yesterday about coming on, and, you know, the news dropped that NBA TV was dropping the starters, but I think of you, and I always think of those guys as sort of blogger pioneers who've made it big, and I just remember loving those early blog days. Do you think about that often?
I do. It's hard not to, especially when you go from sort of the wild, wild west of those early days, writing for Fan House and then writing for Deadspin for a little bit under Will Leach, and then writing for Yahoo, to, you know, working for slightly larger corporations that, you know, you can't just grab a photo off of Google Images anymore for your post. You kind of got to go through the proper channels and stuff like that. So I do think about those days, but, you know, and I also think about the Yahoo experience a lot, because you bring up Skeets and the starters, and you know, he and I were there at the same time with a bunch of other guys that have, you know, moved on to bigger and better things or are still, you know, doing the job there. And those blogs, man, I just think they hit at the right time. They allowed us all to establish ourselves in different ways. And I kind of wish that they had stayed the course with those. I think one of the big mistakes that my former employer made was getting away from a moment in which there were so many unique voices and unique approaches on how to cover things, and sort of a cult of personality around those blogs. And then they kind of just sort of de-emphasized that. And you look at the example of, say, Barstool, for example, which is, you know, is very, very dissimilar in many ways from the Yahoo blogs. But one similarity is that it was a cult of personality and a sense of belonging to something that was, bigger than the site that built that audience. And I think in a lot of ways built the Yahoo Blogs audience, and then they just sort of missed that and went a different direction.
Yeah, you hit on a very interesting point. And, you mentioned Barstool, and they've built, no matter how anyone feels about Barstool, I know everyone has their own opinions. I think maybe some people disagree, but for me, take away everything else, I don't know how you can't be impressed by the loyalty of the fans that they've built. And you had that, I know, with Puck Daddy. I had that back in the Hot Clicks days. I mean, I think Twitter changed the game because it gives everyone more options. But pre-Twitter, you were able to really build that loyal fan base. And it was really one of the coolest things I know for me. You had a really diehard following with Puck Daddy as well over there at Yahoo.
Yeah, and that was the most exhilarating thing about it, was the idea that you were covering hockey in a completely different way. And going back to 2008, when me and Leahy and Lambert and others started on the blog, I mean, it wasn't commonplace for hockey to be covered on the blogs. It wasn't commonplace for sort of a more American pop culture, fan-centric approach to hockey to be in the zeitgeist. And, it was hard sometimes to kick down some doors and get respect. And in the early days, convince, people that were giving out credentials, we could make the dick joke, but we can also write a really good feature story about your player.
Right.
And that was a tough sell at first. And then gradually as the sports culture changed and a reverence sort of crept in and teams got more comfortable with the idea of there being, alternative media in their press box, it got a lot easier. And it also got a lot easier too. I'm not going to lie that we had a really, really big readership.
Right.
The NHL, started to really play ball with us when they realized that we had a voice and what we wrote was important and that the communicating with us was better than not communicating with us, and making sure that we had the facts and some behind the scenes stuff was going to make for better coverage. So it was a gradual process, but I think that to lead it back to your question, I think that directly speaks to the following that we built allowed us to reach that point of quasi respectability.
I'm going to be a bad host here and sort of go backwards. Take me through what year did you start at Yahoo and create Puck Daddy, and how many years did you do that for Yahoo before going to ESPN?
We started in 2008, and this is my second year at ESPN. Right. And so I was working at a local chain of weekly newspapers in Virginia doing high school sports and also arts and entertainment, because in New York for a newspaper, you have to wear many hats. And so, the whole time I was sort of writing hockey on the side for some different websites. And Jamie Mottram, who is another name from the past for digital media, had gone from AOL to Yahoo and built the Yahoo Sports blogs. And he recruited me for a hockey blog. And at the time, it was called the NHL Experts blog, which I really always enjoyed that hubris. They decided to not go with that. He and I went back and forth. At one point, Zamboni Pony was going to be an option for the name of the blog.
Zamboni
and then we settled
Pony.
On Puck Daddy. But the real struggle was to convince him to take on a hockey writer full time. Because at the time, the powers that be were looking for a part-time writer. And, I was doing pretty well at the newspaper as far as scratching out a living. And I didn't want to go someplace and only work part-time. And I said, look, if you really want this to be a success, bring me in full-time and it'll be a success. And luckily they took a chance on me and took a chance on my staff, and we, made it a success.
What do you think the key was to becoming a success? Obviously hard work is one thing, but do you think it was bringing a new voice? Do you think it was the passion you had for the NHL? What combination of things? How were you able to build that audience, grow that audience, and keep it so loyal?
It was three things. The first is to try to, like you said, the voice was really important. And the voice was something where, I wrote the majority of the articles and the posts, so the voice was very much mine. But it was also one that everybody who worked on the site kind of contributed to. We used to actually have a 3-joke minimum for posts. I mean, if it, outside of like the death of Gordie Howe, like we're going to put like 3 jokes in that. But we tried to keep the tone in a certain way, and I think that rule really helped do that. That even in like the stories that were more serious, we were able to kind of just like lighten it up a little bit and keep it entertaining at the very least. I think that was a huge thing. I think there was a lot of things that were just kind of lucky timing wise, where there hadn't really been anything like us, you know, to come around. I think the fact that we involved the community as much as we did, that was huge. Like,
right.
To cast as wide a net as we could in our daily like link roundup to different voices that didn't necessarily ever have a lot of people reading them, and I would get notes all the time from like small blogs on like Blogspot and places like that. They were just like thanking me for pitching traffic their way and bringing, you know, readers to their site for the first time, and they would see a bump and coverage. So I mean, it was cool. And then,
yeah.
You know, on top of all that, just I think frequency was big. You know, when I was working at Deadspin, the frequency of posting was a really big thing that I took away from there, which is that if you're somebody sitting at your desk at work and you're going to a sports site, every time you go should be something new. And so we used to post something every hour on Puck Daddy, and maybe that was to our detriment as far as the time we spent on the site or traffic-wise. I have no idea, but I just know that people got into the routine that every time they came to the site, there would be something different there, and I very much stole that from Deadspin.
And that was the place to steal stuff from back then. They were the top dogs, you know, back in that era. Now, obviously, the entire game and what we do, I mean, what we do is different, but in that same vein, it all changed, I think, and you, if you disagree, let me know, when Twitter came along. So to be successful today now, what do you think the keys are? Is it the same or is it different?
The biggest change for me was definitely in that community sense. Like you said, like we used to hold chats during the day. We used to hold chats during games. And we would just see the numbers fall off a cliff after Twitter rose to prominence. I mean, it just, the conversation moved to Twitter, it moved to Reddit, and it was just sort of this dispersal of the audience away from centralized locations. And that really kind of, you know, I think affected some of the more communal aspects of what we did. But to be successful today, I mean, I think platform matters. I don't think if I was still at Yahoo that I would be doing as well as I am. I just think that, you know, you have to be in a place that knows how to package your stuff and promote your stuff and you know, get it in front of people. So, you know, when I write something now that touches on a number of different topics and it gets sent directly to people's phones and everybody has the ESPN app, I mean, it's great. It's a really handy way for people to find your work.
Yeah.
But as far as like doing what we did back in the day, I mean, I just think it's really hard now to build that community and to have people feel like they're a part of something, because there are just so many other places where you can feel that way. Like, you know, that we were an oasis in a lot of ways for hockey fans. Mm-hmm. Now hockey fans have tons and tons of choices to kind of get their fill.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. And then about 2 years ago, you make the decision to leave Yahoo and go to ESPN to become their senior NHL writer. I know you also have the podcast ESPN on Ice. How difficult was that decision? And I think that, you know, when you were sort of the, you know, like you used the phrase early on in this interview, back then the blogs, Wild Wild West, and then you go to ESPN, you know, it was a little culture shock there, I guess. But tell me about that decision and what your thought process was.
Well, the decision gets a lot easier when they lay off your staff, which is what happened at Yahoo. And, you know, I had a choice in front of me, which is to try to, you know, take it and change Puck Daddy and morph it and shape it and do it with a group of people that I didn't hire and that I didn't really know and that weren't even like in the same country as me. So I made the decision that like I didn't want to try to recreate something I already created. And you know, the ESPN thing came along at a time when they had a big staffing change and they were talking about trying to change the direction of how they approached hockey. I think it was maybe a little bit too news-centric and not enough culture-centric, and fan-centric and dealing with the topics that were in the conversation. And so, you know, they hired Emily Kaplan, they hired me, and I think that the results have been great since then. And as far as the culture shock, yeah, I mean, it's always a culture shock when you go from a place where it's the wild, wild west, you're your own editor, you're kind of throwing everything up against the wall, and most of it sticks because, you know, it's not a place that has rights and things of that nature. And here, you generally learn where the line is, and it's been fine. I mean, it's not a situation where I can write as colorfully, language-wise, and right. as a native of the great state of New Jersey. I think you know what I mean. but I can still write challenging pieces and be opinionated and attack the NHL when it needs to be attacked, and all those things that I was able to do at Yahoo.
I know that you've never been shy about voicing your opinions on Twitter. That's why I've always enjoyed following you, and you often like to mix it up on there. Have you gotten in trouble at ESPN for anything you've tweeted, or you've been behaved since going to the
No, never, there? Never. Okay, I think you know when you're working at a place that there are topics you want to avoid, and it's not even because inevitably it always comes back to the politics stuff. I just got exhausted by it.
Right, like, right. I don't even mean politics. First of all, I think a lot of us are in that same boat where we were like, you know, flabbergasted by what was going on, tweeted about it a lot, and now we're sort of numb to it. And
yeah,
a big part, you know, of it. But there's other ways to get in trouble on Twitter.
My hiring at ESPN was hilarious. I think I've told this story before in a podcast, but I had written a piece about P.K. Subban and Black Lives Matter and the anthem protests and everything. Mm-hmm. And it got picked up by Breitbart.
Right, right.
And there was this huge, super big controversy. And, you know, people are coming at me and my mentions are filled by all the Breitbart people and everything. And then like, my last day at Yahoo was coming up pretty soon. So I, like, announced I was leaving Yahoo. And then immediately everybody thought it was because I got fired for writing something that got picked up by Breitbart.
Right.
And then, of course, the ultimate irony is that my next job is ESPN.
Right,
which is,
exactly.
You know, just really a hilarious series of events. But no, I mean, the one thing I have to say that I had to pull back on, and this was a cognizant decision, was watching, you know, a broadcast that we have, whether it's the NBA or the NFL or whatever, and maybe being ticked off about something an announcer says, or being ticked off about like a decision the director makes, or things like that. I mean, like, we all do it.
Yep.
But it's when you're working for that company, the last thing you want to do is insult a coworker now,
right.
I think is the only thing I've had to really be cognizant of. And that's not anybody saying don't do it. That's me being like, it's probably not the best thing to do.
Right. It's just common sense. Yes. Believe me, there are SI people I would want to insult on Twitter too, and I don't do it. So it's just common sense.
I've never had anybody come to me and say, don't tweet something or you know, give me grief for having tweeted something. And that's also sort of like your maturation as a very online person, where, you know, now my pointless fights with people center around hockey, when in maybe 2 years ago they would have centered around other issues, and you just end up getting in these you're just pissing in the wind for 24 hours straight, and it just sprays back in your face.
Yeah. Another sort of evolution that we've all sort of gone through from those early blogging days is then we all sort of end up with a podcast, it seems like. I know you did a very popular one while you were at Yahoo, and now you have the one at ESPN. Do you enjoy doing the podcast as much as writing? Love doing the podcast? Is it, because I know for me, when I'm doing this, when I'm speaking to you, I love it. Everything around it drives me nuts, like booking it and promoting it. So I'm just curious what your feelings are on that.
Well, you do catch me on a day when I'm trying to juggle the schedule of two different podcasts around a Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final, which has just been a nightmare in and of itself. But no, I mean, so I used to do a daily Puck Daddy radio thing with a guy named Rob Pizzo in Canada. And then after that, me and Jeff Merrick did the Merrick versus Wyszynski podcast for several years, and it was one of the most exhilarating experiences of my life. I mean, you talk about building community and building fan base and building people that give a crap about what you do. I mean, that was probably the apex of it. It was such a rewarding experience. And one of those, like, people coming up to you still years after it ended saying, these podcasts helped me through some really bad times and things of that nature. So it was a treasure of a time. And then the two I do today are ESPN on Ice with Emily. on ESPN, and then we do Puck Soup, which me and Dave Lozo hosted for a couple of years, and then Lozo left to be concentrated on being a writer for Katie Nolan's show. And so me and Down Goes Brown and Ryan Lambert do it now. And it's been really, really wonderful to take something that was successful and then kind of tweak it and morph it and shape it. And it became even more successful than it was. But long-winded answer to your short question, which is I wish I could do a podcast every day. I wish I could get on the air and yell about hockey every single day. I wish there was 2 hours of the day in which it was just me taking calls, talking to guests, doing the podcast thing, but doing it every day. I would love nothing more than that. But that said, there's nothing that replaces the exhilaration of piecing together a story that you know is impactful and writing the big column after an event like a Game 7. Like, that's still going to be the favorite thing that I do in life.
Yeah, and I've seen you on TV. I know you're getting into that too, because obviously if you go to ESPN, that's sort of the progression. How's that treating you?
It's good, man. Like, so, you know, what's been really fun about that is that you figure if you're at ESPN, wherever you go, there's going to be, like, you know, a guy holding a camera pointing it at you, or a studio with a camera set up where you're doing these shows. And most of the time, it's very DIY. It's like, I have a tripod I travel with. There's a cell phone that I use to, you know, sync up with the board back in Bristol. I'm using, you know, I'm carrying around a microphone with a microphone flag in my backpack with my laptop. There's a part of that that's really, you know, hearkening back to those early blog days and those early newspaper days of, hey kids, let's put on a show.
Right.
And then you watch it on TV and you would never know. Like, it looks so good. So I've been doing Hits on the Daily Wager, which I think is a really fun show, and also an interesting one, because hockey and gambling is clearly in an interesting spot going forward as far as the potential for it to really change the way that people watch the game and potentially affect the popularity of the sport. And then I've done a bunch of hits on Outside the Lines as sort of their go-to de facto hockey guy when weird things happen or cool things happen. And that's been great, because that's a show I used to watch all the time.
Right.
It's kind of like when I got hired at Yahoo and I was already playing fantasy football. Like, I was already watching Outside the Lines, and
right.
And then I get to be on it too.
Let's talk about covering the NHL. It's not exactly a secret that in America there are a few more sports that are more popular than the NHL. And let's start with this. Does that ever bum you out when you see all the attention that the NBA is getting or the NFL? Or you've been doing this so long, you're completely used to that, and you have a big enough audience where you don't get that jealous pang?
Oh, no, it's not jealousy at all. It is inspiring, because you know that in order to break through that noise, you have to be that good, and you have to find stories that resonate on such a large scale, that's the only way you're going to break through that cacophony. I mean, that was the way it always was at Yahoo, and it's the same at ESPN, is that we know that any single thing that happens in the Warriors-Raptors series is going to get play,
right?
And it's going to get huge play, and it's going to do great numbers, and it should, because that series has been fascinating and dramatic and wonderful. So, you know, for me, it's like, how do I go about getting, you know, through that? Well, it's finding the human side of players. It's talking about controversies. It's finding stories like the St. Louis Post-Dispatch running the congratulatory letter from the St. Louis Blues owner saying that they already won the cup. You know, it's like it's finding those stories that I know are going to, you know, break through the hockey bubble and find a larger audience. And so I never lament the fact that hockey isn't as big as those other sports, because I think it's part of my responsibility, not only as a journalist, but also as a hockey fan, to find ways to make people pay attention to the thing I love.
So as a veteran of this business, and you've seen it all from the blogs to the big company like ESPN, and you've been doing this a long time, where do you stand on the issue of, we have this issue sort of at SI, and truth be told, I mean, I've told SI for years, I said, if you want to get traffic to hockey, hire Greg Wyshynski, but nobody listens to me. That's besides the point. I'm curious where you stand on the issue of, you know, a sports media company could say, we don't cover as hockey as much as maybe we should because it doesn't get the traffic, or is it you're not getting the traffic because you're not covering it the way you should?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I mean, I think, and there's a lot of layers to it. I mean, there's no question that it doesn't get as popular as much. It's not as popular as other sports. There's no question that at the most important time of the year, the audience tends to dissipate a little bit. I mean, you know, people aren't following hockey as much in the middle of June as they would be, you know, if it was maybe the championship was held in the winter or something like that. I think it's always been a problem.
Why do you think, I've never heard that before. Why do you think that is? I'm curious. It's an interesting.
It's a combination of a couple things. I mean, you know, psychologically, you know, one of the assumptions has always been the idea that when it is the middle of June and your kids are out of school and you're thinking about the beach and you're thinking about the pool, you're not thinking about the ice.
Right.
And that's always been kind of a challenge. And then the other thing is that, hockey fans, and this has long been the belief, is that hockey fans are very tribal by nature, and that when their teams are eliminated, they tend not to continue to watch the playoffs. So, you know, if every hockey fan that watches hockey on the regular, during the regular season and during the playoffs, all watch the Stanley Cup final, numbers would be huge, but they don't for whatever reason. And so even though the ratings have been strong for this series, they I've always felt like they could be exponentially better if everybody was kind of on board and watched the sport after their team was eliminated. This is kind of how it is.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So the other question then again about, is it lack of coverage or is it the lack of traffic leads to the lack of coverage?
I think let me bring it back to ESPN.
Sure.
One of the challenges that we have is that we're not a rights holder, right? So I don't think it's any secret that the sports that which the ESPN holds for which ESPN holds the rights get a lot of coverage, and they go and put studio shows there, and then you get to see a lot of stuff about those things. And you know, I think hockey fans saw that when the World Cup of Hockey was aired on ESPN, they bumped up the studio coverage. They talked about it more. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge for me and Emily and all the people that are on the hockey side is because we haven't had the rights for a long time, people have been kind of trained not to come to ESPN necessarily for hockey.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only are we trying to give them a reason to come there and read stuff by putting out good content, but also trying to kind of plant a flag and say, look, you know, the people that we talk to within the company tell us that hockey is becoming more and more prevalent in their conversations because the game is faster, there's more scoring, there's a generation of young stars. When I was hired, that was the message sent to me. It's like, it's a really good time to write about hockey just because of the uptick and sort of the excitement and all that other stuff. So I think the challenge for us is to try to say, hey, you know, there are legions of hockey fans inside the company. If you walk around that newsroom, you'd be stunned by how many Bruins flags and Whalers flags and Predators flags and stuff that are on people's desks. But also that, you know, this is going to be a place that you know, covers the hell out of the sport. And you should come there every day expecting to see fantastic coverage, even if you haven't been coming there in recent years.
So I'm curious, where do you see the NHL's future in terms of coverage, with obviously streaming, and you know, ESPN now has ESPN Plus, and obviously we have DAZN, DAZN, whatever it's called. And I should know this, and I apologize for not knowing the exact details of the NBC contract if it's up anytime soon. But do you do you think the NHL would do a streaming deal with someone? Obviously, the Stanley Cup Finals will always be on network TV or ESPN or something like that. But regular season, you think there's an opportunity there for the NHL to branch out, expand? How do you see that going?
I can only speak to what I've heard from people around the league, because obviously anything that's happening at my shop is way above my pay grade. But I know for a fact that the Board of Governors and people within the power structure of the NHL have been very hungry in the next deal to spread the wealth.
Yeah.
You know, the monolithic deal with NBC produced an incredible amount of revenue, and they were able to put out a lot of press releases with the word billion in it. But there's been enormous pressure on Gary Bettman and the NHL itself to, you know, to make the kind of deal that the NFL has, that the NBA has, that Major League Baseball has, to cast their lot with different networks and trying to maximize exposure. So I fully expect that's going to be the case in the next TV deal. When it comes to streaming, I mean, I kind of forgot to mention this before, but like part of the reason why there's been an uptick in interest at ESPN about hockey is that we have games. They're on Plus.
Right.
There was a game every night, basically on ESPN Plus, in the crease with Linda Cohen and Buchgrass and Barry Melrose has been a highlight show that's been on every night. Mm-hmm. And so that has certainly helped us from a coverage perspective, because now that they have the games, they want to promote the games. Emily and I are writing stories about teams that are in the games, and then that gets featured pretty prominently because they want people to come and watch the games on streaming. So that's been a huge boon for us in the last year. And I think that it also speaks to answer your question, I think it speaks to the possibilities that are there for the NHL to, you know, cast a lot with a couple of TV networks and then explore all opportunities for where to stream the games, you know, whether it's some of these places that are looking to, you know, acquire a marquee league to attract fans to their service, or even if it's a legacy company. I think all things are on the table for them as far as what the next deal might be.
Looks like the next deal will happen after the 2021 season. That's when NBC's contract is up. And yeah, I mean, it does. I think NBC, it's almost, I don't want to say it's irrelevant, but it's almost irrelevant what NBC does from the standpoint of, no matter what they do, the NHL is tied in with one network. And like you said, it seems like it would really benefit the sport if they can loop in, you know, two or three networks to air the games.
Yeah, I just always thought that was logical. Like, I remember back in the last negotiation, I mean, you know, there was talk about potentially, you know, games ending up on Spike TV or things like that at the time. And I just think that the more you spread out your product, the more it gets featured in teasers and commercials and what have you during programming that maybe that your fans aren't the only ones watching. And, you know, I just think that spreading the wealth is the best decision for them, at least in the States. I mean, in Canada, obviously, you're dealing with two giant media organizations in Rogers and TSN that are just going to be, or Bell Media, that are always going to be like warring over the rights, and either one or the other will get them. But I mean, here in the States, there are just so many different options now that I think from what I gather, again, from conversations within the NHL's power structure, it just seems like a no brainer that in this next deal, they're going to spread the wealth. Yeah.
It's funny because I'm thinking of baseball, and I do feel like, obviously, that's an audience that's dwindling, gets older, et cetera, et cetera. But I do feel like when the baseball postseason starts, you see a million ads for it. I think it's promoted very well. I think you can't avoid it. But then, you know, you want to watch a game and you don't know what the hell channel, if it's on, you don't know if it's on FS1, ESPN, MLB Network, and you're all confused when that happens. So I guess there's a slight downside to that.
There always is. But yeah. I mean, you know, the real issue beyond that availability of games and putting it on different networks, obviously, is, you know, and this is something I've been working towards since 2008, even before that, is just broadening the fan base, you know, giving other people that haven't checked out the sport a reason to check it out. Changing the demographic makeup of the sports fan base is essential to its growth and its success. And it's, like I said earlier, man, it's a lot of different cultural issues, economic issues, stereotypical issues that are always going to be in the sports way. We're chipping away at it, but it's still a pretty steep hill to climb.
But before we wrap, I'm curious. I want to get your take on NHL players. Let me ask you this: have you developed relationships with more players since going to ESPN and focusing more on the stories you're doing there than you were at Puck Daddy, or has it been the same in terms of getting to know players, contacts, stuff like that?
I think we get pitched more, just because we're there, and I think that, you know, when you have all these different platforms, whether it be TV, or, you know, for the last couple of years, the magazine, even though it's sadly gone by the wayside, you know, there's always going to be agents and representatives and marketing companies that are pitching you players because they know that you have those platforms.
Right.
So I think we get a lot more of that coming at us than I did at Yahoo for obvious reasons. But as far as my approach, man, like I've always had good relationships with GMs. I have relationships with some players, but I think they're just players who sort of understand and appreciate my unique approach to coverage, necessarily me buddying up to them or what have you. But so that hasn't really changed. Yeah. But you know, I think these guys know that, you know, when you are working for ESPN, that there's a certain maybe comfortability there that they might not have had in other places, where they know there's a power structure, they know that there's an editor, and they know essentially that, you know, there's going to be some journalistic levels above you maybe that are going to make them feel more comfortable and sitting down for a long Q&A or coming on the podcast, for example, with me and Emily. But I think the best way to put it is I'm Puck Soup. I curse a lot and we talk pop culture and I make horrible jokes and say go on Howard Beale rants. And it might be harder to get a player for that than it is for ESPN on Ice, where it's still great and still ranty, but much more, I think, in keeping with a traditional sort of radio setup.
See, in my warped mind, it should be easier to get guests on the other one because that's where you're having a fun conversation and letting it all letting it all flow.
Well, part of it's also on Puck Soup. We don't go for them a lot.
Right.
Puck Soup was always sort of this place where we had for a long time a no players rule, where we just wanted to talk to hockey fans and talk to people that were, you know, part of hockey culture and, you know, actors and things of that nature. So I don't know. It may not necessarily be even a home for a player to appear on or a GM to appear on, but I definitely know that, you know, that being an independent, you know, a podcast that has, you know, funded by advertisers and a Patreon versus being the flagship hockey podcast of ESPN, I'm pretty sure I know which one is easier to book.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't want to get into too much Bruins Blue stuff only because we're taping this on Tuesday. It comes out Wednesday. Then there's a game Wednesday night. But just before we wrap, there's obviously nothing better than a game seven. So this sort of played out as good as it could have for you from a fan standpoint and a business standpoint, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's the first one since 2011 when the Bruins beat the Canucks, and then Vancouver tried to burn down the city afterwards, which was its own story. It's been a really entertaining series, and it's been a crazy playoff. And if nothing else, like, I've been inspired by the success that we've had from a numbers perspective, and that NBC's had from a ratings perspective. Having a postseason where weird stuff has happened, you know, like the Lightning going out in a sweep in the first round, Carolina going on their run,
right?
The Blues going from worst in January to the Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final, and people have the same people who always bitch about not being able to being forced to watch the same teams over and over again, like, oh, another outdoor game with the Blackhawks. Well, they bellied up and they watched the games that didn't involve the legacy teams. There were more renowned franchises in the draft lottery this year than there were in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And yet the numbers and the interest and everything else was really strong. And that was impressive. But I got to tell you, man, like it's been really fun to cover the Blues. I've been out west. I moved from Manhattan to San Jose in February because my wife got a new job. And so I was covering sort of the Western Conference on the reg for the first time. And it's been great. The really fascinating team, really fascinating players. And the kinds of human interest stories, like their anthem singer who was battling multiple sclerosis said this was going to be his last season, and then they go all the way to the final possible home game for him to sing. The Layla Anderson, the little girl who was battling this rare disease, became kind of like the inspiration for the team. Like, there's been a ton of stories on that side of the ledger that are the ones we talked about before that break through the cacophony and get huge numbers, even when it's hockey. And then on top of that, I got to cover some really, really controversial stuff, like the major penalty in the San Jose Las Vegas game, rather, that resulted in the Sharks' comeback, the missed hand pass in overtime in the Blue Shark series. It's been a really it's been a fun playoff to cover because there's been a ton of different things to write about. You had controversy stuff, you had player stuff, you had game stuff, and then you had sort of that off ice featurey, E60 kind of stuff, and it's been really, really fun.
Well, I'm glad I finally was able to get you on, and it's great to see an old school blogger kicking ass over at ESPN.
Oh, thanks, man.
And we got to do a show. We got to do a show one day just about what that era was like pre-Twitter when the blogs are flying. That was so fun.
Yeah, there's a book there somewhere. I know
there
that one of those is either Big Lead or Awful Announcing at one point did a look back at Fan House, which is a lot of fun. That was if you're a fan of the old school internet, look up that sort of oral history because it was really eye opening for exactly how that thing fell apart when they devalued the people bringing in traffic and then paid way too much for guys like Jay Mariotti.
It was wild.
But yeah, we should do this again because every time I listen to this podcast, and I am a regular listener,
I appreciate
my
that.
God, man, you know, Sopranos, Seinfeld, wrestling. These are my lifeblood. This is arguably the most focused interview you've done on this podcast in maybe 3 years.
I'm trying to be very respectful to the NHL audience out there. I haven't had when I have you on a second time, well, you know, I want to sort of explain to people why you're such an internet legend, and now you're at ESPN too. So, you know, I don't want to ask any questions that, you know, they may scoff at over there. I know everything has to be approved. You know, even when I get Scott Van Pelt on, they got to approve it. So I'm trying to keep you out of trouble, you know. I have to say, the thing, the two,
I do appreciate that.
If you go through the years of us maybe like tweeting back and forth at each other, I think the thing we've probably tweeted about the most of each other is wrestling stuff. I know you're a huge wrestling guy, so I we'll definitely have you on again to chat about the fun stuff.
Yeah, it is cool. It is cool when you know I'm checking my feed or whatever, and all of a sudden I realize you've chatted up like Roman Reigns or you know any of those people. I'm like, wow, that'd be a real fascinating conversation. Kind of jealous of Jimmy for landing these interviews while I'm chasing down Colton Parayko of the St. Louis Blues to talk about Game 7.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate you saying that, because you can let me plug the fact that Seth Rollins is supposed to be on this podcast next week. So there you go.
There he is. All right. The Legend Slayer, King Slayer, or whatever the hell they're calling him these days.
Yeah, I think it's... No, I think Randy Orton's the Legend Slayer, but I'm not sure. I'm not watching it much these days.
He's Tyler Black, so who cares?
Yeah, that's inside. All right, Greg, enjoy Game 7. Appreciate you coming on, and be well.
Thanks, Jimmy.
All right, take care. All right, good chat there with Greg Wyshynski. Before we get to Rich O'Malley, quick word here from our sponsor. All right, this is going to be weird, but I'm a good friend, so let's see if I can get through this. Joining me now, one of my best friends in life, been best friends since college, and he wrote a book. He's an author. I wrote the foreword, so I got to help him sell some books. He used to work at the Daily News. Like I said, now he's an author. Rich O'Malley, the author of One Lucky Fan, a book about him seeing every stadium and arena for the four major sports leagues, every team. Rich, how are you?
Jimmy, thank you for having me on. I realized as I was gearing up for this, I think we passed the 25-year mark recently.
Of friendship? Yeah, I know. We have to do this like a straight interview. We can't do this like one of our phone conversations. So, and I'll say this.
Oh, boy.
Actually, let me just say this right off the bat. This is how good of a friend I am. I am breaking one of my top rules for hosting this podcast, which is I don't want to interview anyone who's promoting a book. Those are the worst interviews by far. They go on every show in America, and you put out the podcast, and then it's like they're tweeting like, oh, I was on the Dan Patrick Show promoting my book. Oh, I was on Jim Rohn promoting my book. Oh, here I was on this podcast promoting my book. And then you just look like a dipshit. And so I don't put people on who are just promoting books. So that's how good of a friend I am.
I appreciate that you know that I am selling my soul here to get this book out in front of as many eyeballs as I can.
All right, so...
Let's just get through it, my
friend.
All right.
So the book is called One Lucky Fan. So here's the deal. Rich has now seen every single stadium and arena for every team in Major League Baseball, National Hockey League, National Basketball Association, and Major League Baseball. Or did I say that one twice? I don't know. But the four majors.
NFL is the last.
NFL, National Football League. Tell people, first of all, how long did this journey take you? And then when you started it, and then how you finished it, give us like the timeline of it.
Sure. I mean, I started back when we were first getting to know each other back at CW Post in college, and we took a couple of road trips together, you and I and some other folks, and our first big one was what we called Trip 1, and we went out to the Midwest and saw a bunch of those stadiums. That was right after Jimmy graduated. And the second one was after I graduated. He's older than me. By one year. And then we took that one a little bigger. And another friend of ours, Petey, and myself, we went all the way across the country for that one. And that's really where this whole thing was born, thinking that someday I might be able to get to all of them.
And then how did you finish it off?
I finished it off in 2017. I took a gigantic trip, which I would advise to absolutely nobody, but I had to do it. It was my mission in life to finish the game, as I call it, and see all 123 before I could write the full story about it. And so I needed 40 more teams. I was about 83 at that point. And so I went on a road trip where I saw 42 games over 53 days. It was a breakneck pace, and no one should ever do anything like that. It's just ridiculous and stupid. It leads to some funny stories, which you'll get in the book.
All right. 42 games in 53 days. How do you know? You usually know this minutia off the top of your head. How many states were you in that time span?
I did write states. I was in 31 metropolitan areas across 16 states and three provinces of our neighbor to the north.
In how many days?
53
days. And you were physically exhausted and mentally exhausted at the end of that, correct?
Completely. I was sick as a dog for Christmas that year. I could barely crawl down the stairs to say hello to my family before I crawled back up and they all opened presents and were happy and had a nice meal and I was miserable in bed.
Would you do it all over again the way you did it, or would you do it differently to get every stadium in?
No, I think I enjoy a good challenge, and so I would probably say I would break it up next time. I like going on these week-long, 10-day, two-week kind of trips. Those are the perfect length. Doing 3 months on the road, almost with no break, living out of a backpack, it's no kind of life. So if anyone else out there wants to take these kinds of trips, I would say, you know, pick your spots. In the Midwest, you can bounce around and get 10 different places over 2 weeks in baseball and football, or depending on the season, if you want to add in basketball, hockey, whatever your thing is. That would be my advice.
All right, let's go through the four major leagues one by one. Let's start with baseball. Give me, to the people listening to this, the one stadium they must absolutely see before they die, and then what is the worst stadium that you would not recommend anyone going to? Go start with MLB.
Okay, so in baseball, you know, aside from the two obvious, you know, cathedrals of baseball, Wrigley and Fenway, top of my list is PNC Bank Park in Pittsburgh. They just did everything right. It's a gorgeous view from your seat. You're overlooking those two bridges and then the city skyline. You feel like you can reach out and touch them. I absolutely adore that place. Right now, the worst place on my list, and people can give me grief for this all they want, I don't care. It's my book. It's my list. The new Atlanta Stadium just brings absolutely nothing to the table. It's boring. They had a chance to really make a nice improvement down there from the TED, from Turner Field, and they just blanked it. I was not a fan at all.
That doesn't seem like a controversial opinion. All right, let's do...
when you have places like Oakland Coliseum and Tampa Bay Dump down there, you know, I mean, those places are pretty obviously bad, too.
Right. All right, let's go to NHL.
Yes.
A must-see arena and then the biggest dump.
I love the new arena in Detroit. It's very unique the way they built it. It almost feels like you're in a mall when you're walking around it, and there's all this stuff over to your right. There's these shops and restaurants, and it's really just very sleek and clean and feels very nice. Upstairs, it's almost like a catwalk. It's not your normal arena hallway, and I really appreciated that. And the other thing that's great about it is they have the bridge viewing, like they have at Madison Square Garden, where you're almost elevated up above the ice and the court when it's there for basketball. So that's a really nice touch, too.
And NBA.
NBA, I'll tell you, I fell in love with Oracle Arena on the trip. And, you know, in a couple of days, it's going to have its swan song because it's departing the NBA.
Right.
They're going to move over to the new Chase Center next year in San Francisco. So that's a loss for the sport. It just had sort of an old-timey charm. They've kept it up to date as best they can. And I see the need for a new place, especially with the Warriors' success right now. But I'll miss that place.
And the biggest dump in the NBA?
Pick your pick. I mean, there are so many cookie-cutter 1990s, you know, monolithic, built too big places, you know, that just come to mind. That's the thing about arenas, is they're very samey. And in the book I say, like, here's like 5 or 10 places you really should go. Here's the places to avoid. Everything that's in the middle, they're all the same. Nothing matters.
All right, well, NFL stadiums are great. So give me the best and the worst there in the National Football League.
Yeah, the best sports experience in America by far, hands down for me, is Green Bay. Lambeau Field is iconic, and you know that extends out of the gates of the stadium and into the tiny town that surrounds it. The feel on a game day there is just you can't replicate that anywhere else in America. I absolutely love it. If you're afraid of the cold and you don't want to go up there, the new Atlanta Stadium, equally great in a different way. They just did everything right, and it's very fan friendly. And you know my least favorite stadium.
Oh yeah, it is the worst. MetLife in New Jersey. Yeah, it's a horrible, gray, building with no charm and no nothing. Yeah, MetLife in Jersey. I saw the first thing. You weren't there that night. It was with other people. The first thing that opened up MetLife was a Bon Jovi concert that we went to.
What a surprise.
And I could not believe what a dump it was. Absolute dump.
I banned it for life in the book.
Give me, now, people who don't know this, Rich is a notorious cheapskate. Give people who want to go on a road trip or want to see multiple stadiums, multiple arenas, a couple of tips for how they can do it without breaking the bank.
Sure. This has gotten a lot easier in the last couple of years, in the last decade or so, with the advent of apps. All of these needs that you had as a traveler in the past, you can now bring up on your phone and change things on the fly in a matter of seconds. And that means, StubHub and SeatGeek, you can drop in there and get a great ticket minutes before a game for often less than face value. That was never the case in the past. You were reliant on really shady scalpers outside the stadium, and it was always tilted in their favor. And then things like flights and hotels, you now have Airbnb, where you can get a cheaper room, and it might not be as comfortable or as convenient, but if you're looking to save a few bucks and you don't mind taking a train to the game from a little bit farther out of town, that's a good place to start too.
You said you mentioned scalpers. It reminds me of when we went to Game 7 of the 2003 ALCS, the Aaron Boone game, and you almost got arrested for scalping a ticket. But
it was your fault.
It was not my fault.
You picked the guy, I think, or at least, I don't know. You were there, and so I blame you.
But it was your ticket.
I almost got arrested.
Yeah, that's in the book.
I would have missed one of the greatest games I ever saw in my life. Probably the greatest, the loudest that stadium ever was when I was in there.
That story is in the book, I believe, right?
Yes, it is.
All right, so tell, last thing here, give me, so you've seen every stadium and arena for all the teams, NBA, NHL, MLB, NFL. Give me one stadium, arena, venue in the world you have not been to that is at the top of your list to go to. Wimbledon or the Kentucky Derby, although you've probably done that, I'm sure. Give me something.
Yes. I would love to go to a World Cup final at some point if Italy or Iceland ever make it. Those are my two sides. Anywhere in the world, really. But, in addition to that, I'd like to go see a number of the English Premier League stadiums, pitches, as they would say over there. That's high on my list as well. Here, I'm missing the Preakness to complete my triple crown, which I'd like to do.
Enough.
And at some point in my life, I need to go to an NASCAR race and see what the hell this is all about.
God, that sounds
so many people
horrible.
Love it, and I've got to see what this is like. It
sounds absolutely horrible. Leave me out of that trip.
I absolutely would never ask you to go on that.
I'm not going to that one. All right. The book is called One Lucky Fan. How can people get it?
They can go online and, first of all, you can look me up on the Twitter. My handle is at Rich O'Malley, RichOmalley.
All right. Don't get carried away giving out. Listen, you're getting carried away with the Twitter handle. Sell the book, not the Twitter handle. Amazon, One Lucky Fan.
You can find the link there, or you can go to. How do you buy a book? You go on the internet, and you go to Barnes & Noble, or you go to Amazon, or you go to Google and type it in,
right.
One Lucky Fan, and it should pop right at the top.
All right, perfect. This is why I hate having people on promoting a book. Then they want to get all crazy with this, that, the other thing.
I could promote some upcoming appearances if you like, but I won't.
You have appearances?
Well, I have one coming up down in Philly here, yes. It's going to be great, and I'm going to sign some books up in a couple of New York City bookstores. So I got stuff like that going on.
All right, let's,
if they go to my Twitter handle, they could look it up.
I'll give the Twitter handle. Don't worry. Let's end on something related to the book. Last question. Give me the single best, this is the fat person in me coming out, single best food item you've eaten at any stadium or arena in this country.
It's very easy, and unfortunately, it's not available anymore, but I can give you backups. My favorite food at any stadium is the Schmitter, which is a delicious sandwich which you could once buy at Phillies games, Citizens Bank Ballpark. It's just a concoction of basically meat and sauces on a bun, and it's delicious. And as the backup to that, you can go to an Eagles game and still get one.
How come they don't have it at the Phillies games anymore? Do we know?
Buy the book and you'll find out.
There you go. See? That's why I don't want to have people on who plug a book. Got to plug the book instead of give the answer. All right. The book is called One Lucky Fan. Rich O'Malley is the author. The foreword was written by Jimmy Traina.
It's very good.
And thank you. And Rich has seen has been to games at every stadium and arena, MLB, NFL, NBA, NHL. One Lucky Fan. All right. We've sold the book.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Anytime. Take care. I'll talk to you later. It's very interesting when you have to interview your friend. It's a little nerve-wracking there. Didn't want to lead him into any stories about me. So my thanks to Greg Wyshynski for coming on from ESPN. And my thanks to my buddy Rich O'Malley. One Lucky Fan is his book. Again, archives, feel free to check out past episodes. Last week, Darren Rovell, Andrew Marchand. Mike Breen, calling the NBA Finals, was on recently, and he was a great guest. Chris Long, newly retired NFL player, in the archives as well. If you can rate and review, helps immensely. Subscribe too would be nice. And that's all we got for this episode. We'll see you next week right here on the SI Media Podcast. Take care.